Click kaya959.co.za.
This is how we do it.
To download the Point of View podcast. POV Music.
On the street.
On the air.
And on the dance floor.
Hello, Sheldon.
Hi, how are you doing?
Yeah, you'd have to be like really, really young.
Yeah.
Not to know that everybody knows the song.
Yes. This is a South African masterpiece. So the theme for today is protest music.
Mm-hmm.
And the protest genre is quite an interesting one. And as we go through the journey of the songs that we've selected for tonight, you'll see how the journey will alter depending on the society within which you're operating. But generally, the traits of a protest song are quite specific.
Mm.
Very minimalistic instrumentation. The harmonics of the song will also usually be very stripped down, very basic, usually because the people that are creating this kind of music are not necessarily very musically educated. They more people who have intellectualized what's happening in society and want to make a comment on society.
Mm.
And the easiest way to spread that message is through music. And so they're not necessarily highly musically educated. And so from a harmonic point of view, the music's very basic and instrumentation also very basic.
Mm.
But more than that, it's also by design, because you don't want a piece of music that's overly ornate or complicated that's going to detract from the message of the song.
Mm.
So those are usually, and the message will be very clear, the focus is on a very specific kind of lyrical content and narrative that the composer and author of the song is trying to communicate. Now, if you listen to this specific song, what is it about? You know, like, how is this a protest song? Because it's just an instrumental.
Yeah.
And it's just, if you listen to it from a very superficial level, you're like, well, it's just some people
you can
improvising.
Tap to it, and you're thinking, yeah, I can tap to it.
And the people are just improvising over each other. There's nothing like, you wouldn't necessarily say this is a protest song.
Mm.
So that was Mannenberg by Abdullah Ibrahim, released in 1974. He was still known as Dollar Brand at this stage.
Mm.
And what was happening in his history at this point was he had left South Africa. He was exiled, but he was like popping into the country every now and again to do some recordings. And in the process of doing that, he met Rashid Wali, who had a record store in town, and through that he happened to have a record company, and they decided that they were going to do some recordings. And they were in the recording studio recording the one time with Basil Coetzee and Robbie Jansen, and they were busy recording. And in a break, Abdullah went, they had an upright piano in the corner, and he started fiddling on the piano, and he came up with this interesting little melody. And then he's like, hey guys, pull in, you do something. And then he's like, turn on the, you know, like switch on the machine and record this. And before you knew it, the song was created. Like just in the spur of the moment right there while they're improvising with each other. Now, the interesting thing about the song is if you listen to the song, you hear the piano in the song doesn't have a characteristic piano sound.
Mm-hmm.
It sounds almost like a harpsichord.
Mm.
And the reason why it sounds that way is because the piano that he was playing on in the recording studio was a cheap upright piano. And what they had done was to create this characteristic sound, they had stuck matchsticks at the back of the hammers on the piano. So when the hammer struck the string, it created this like almost like a very hollow sound, like a harpsichord, as opposed to the dampened sound that you would hear when the felts of the hammers on the piano would hit the string. And so that's why you get this almost like clangy piano sound on this track. Now, how does it become a protest song? Now, Mannenberg was the district into which a lot of people were moved in 1968 because of the Group Areas Act. People relocated from their neighborhoods into different areas for different people. That was what the Group Areas Act was all about. So this is 1968. And Abdullah Ibrahim was from Mannenberg. And when this so when they started composing the song, like, this was a very contentious issue at the time. Now, if you listen to the song, you can hear elements of Afrikaans music in it. You can hear elements of, like, traditional Marabi music in it. You can hear elements of Western music in it. And it's almost a commentary on, like, what is the society that we're in? What is it a reflection of? And only through audio and not necessarily through lyrics. So the protest was more a protest of, like, we need to unify as a people. And these are all the different flavors I'm going to add to the music here. And that's how I'm going to communicate the message of, we need to unite as a people. Mm. We need to stop being separate, which was apartheid, separateness. Mm. And so he was trying to bring unity through the song and through the music. Now, the song was originally very well received, but it was, the way they promoted the song was very, I would say, almost like a guerrilla tactic. Mm. So apparently in the 1970s, the way people used to market songs would be, you would have your record store, and this was a record store in town, and then you would take your speakers into the public, you would turn them around, and you would play the music into the crowd. And then people would come and buy a little cassette, and they would give you like 10 rand, and then off you go with your cassette, and they sold 5,000 units just by doing it that way. Eventually, the popularity of the song grew to such an extent that they landed up signing a deal with Gallo Records, and then it got distributed. And within the first 7 months, it sold 50,000 units, which is massive for a song of this nature, like a jazz piece, which jazz is not really like very mainstream. Mm. And to kind of generate this kind of, it means that it was hitting people in the right place. Mm. But more than that, what started happening was that Basil Coetzee and Robbie Jensen started using it at different rallies. So they'd play the song at rallies. And through that, a political association to the song started growing. A narrative that connected politics to the song became apparent. And through that, it became this anthem. Although no lyrics, just a very basic instrumental song.
Your next song.
So my next song is Kendrick Lamar. So now we're going from one extreme to the very next extreme. So the song is All Right. It's quite interesting the way... So Kendrick Lamar is probably one of the greatest poets that we've had. Like, if you think of Bob Dylan, I would put Kendrick Lamar in that bracket, because Bob Dylan's original music was based on poetry, and Kendrick Lamar is essentially a poet that is making music and adding his poetry to music. But anyway, he's also one of the first Pulitzer Prize winning musicians not to come from the jazz or classical world. So he's not one of the first, he is the first Pulitzer Prize winner not to have come from a jazz or a classical music background.
Interesting.
So that is how significant his music is. But anyway, this specific song was co-written by Pharrell Williams and obviously Kendrick Lamar, and it was from his 2015 album To Pimp a Butterfly, which is a masterpiece album. But so hip-hop obviously has been often associated with protest music, and that's the origins of hip-hop. But this here, you can hear some of those characteristic elements of protest music. Very simple. So although it's hip-hop, he's stripped down a lot of the elements so that you can really focus on the lyrics. And then what he's also done, he's alluded to elements of civil rights moments that you would pick up on if you're part of that community. So he starts the song with a reference to The Color Purple, and he talks about how all his life he hasn't been recognized, and how his life has been a struggle. And although the song was pre-Black Lives Matter, when the Black Lives Matter movement started happening, a lot of the young protesters were reciting the lyrics of this specific song, and it became very closely associated to the Black Lives Matter movement.
Okay, so that, as you said, very different to how we started the show.
No, no, very different. And both songs, actually these, so the All Right and the Childish Gambino, This Is America, both are linked to the Black Lives Matter movement. Yeah. But interestingly enough, so the Childish Gambino song started off, when Childish Gambino started writing the song, or I think it's Daniel Glover, right?
Yeah.
He started, his original concept was that it was going to be a comedic song. Mm. That was what he was going to do. Mm. And it was going to be a Drake diss track.
Mm-hmm.
All right. That he was going to be dissing Drake. And as he was composing the song, he was like, yo, this song is too serious for it to be a comedic diss track. It needs to be something more substantial. Interestingly enough, though, at the beginning of the year, I don't know if you saw the, one of my favorite things to watch, other than the Grammy Awards every year, like one of my musical events,
mm-hmm.
is the Super Bowl performance.
Yeah, no, they go all out.
Exactly. I hate sport, all right? I despise sport.
You think more than me.
If there's one thing I cannot stand, is sport. But the halftime show is a hell of a thing, and I love watching it. It's amazing what they do, because they have to turn that state, that they've got to turn that field around in a very short space of time. They've got to do the performance, they've got to break down, and then they've got to do the rest of the match. So it's quite a monumental task. And Kendrick Lamar performed this year. He performed one of my favorite songs of the year, Not Like Us, which was a Drake diss track. All right, so everyone's going after Drake. I don't blame them. I don't think Drake's a very good rapper, although he's a very big selling rapper and he's had a lot of commercial success. I don't think he's a particularly good rapper. I think the slow rapping style just doesn't work for me. But anyway, Childish Gambino started the idea of doing the song as a diss track, and then eventually decided that it was going to be more about what is happening in society in America, and he references many different ills in society at the time. Now, this song was 2018, which is closer to the Black Lives Matter movement, and so it became very closely associated to the movement. In it, he talks about police brutality. He talks about gang violence. He talks about gun violence. He talks about systemic racism. And he does that with all within the auspices of this beautiful piece of composition. The interesting thing and the similarity between the Kendrick song and this song is that you can hear that the song is very intentional.
Mm.
The pace is very intentional. Mm. If it was anything else, you would have had a much faster pace, but these two songs are almost at a heartbeat pace or a walking pace, and the reason for that is because the song is trying to strike you at a heartbeat level, and so by keeping the beats of the song low, you are calming the audience down, and you're making them focus in on the message of the song. Both songs, very light instrumental, very minimalistic, a very strong emphasis on the lyrical content of both songs.
Kaya 959.
We are Rhythm and Beats.
Gotta be very, very young not to know the song.
Oh, goodness. I was 9 years old when the song was released, 1985. And this song still makes me want to cry every time I hear it. It's just such a beautiful piece of music.
Is it because it's a great piece of music, or is it because you have so much talent in one room?
I think that's what it is, actually. Yeah. And you know what I think makes me really emotional about the song is the fact that all these amazing individuals wanted to be in one room at the same time.
This is it.
To use their talent to make a difference.
Yeah.
And I think it was one of the first times where this actually happened.
Mm.
And I remember watching it and being so emotional about, like, hearing, and also the clever way in which Quincy Jones positioned all the voices so that they flowed beautifully between one voice and the next.
Because they are so different.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so the dichotomy between the different voices, that's what makes it so emotionally stirring. Mm. So the song was actually meant to be written by Lionel Richie and Stevie Wonder. But every time that they tried to get hold of Stevie Wonder, he was just too busy. And so he never got back to them. And when Michael Jackson heard that they were doing the song, so actually the whole thing started with Harry Belafonte. Now, Harry Belafonte has got a very strong link back to South African protest music. Mm-hmm. He is the guy who orientated and introduced Shuma Sakela and Miriam Makeba to the world. Mm. Anyway, so Harry Belafonte was watching TV and he saw a charity single being done by Sir Bob Geldof, a song called Do They Know It's Christmas Time? And it was a huge Christmas hit, and it was done specifically to aid the plight of the Ethiopian people during their famine in the 1980s. 1 million people died in that famine. Anyway, and Harry Belafonte was like, why are the white people doing things for our people? Mm. Why are we not doing something for our own people in Africa? And he contacted Quincy Jones. Quincy Jones contacted Lionel Richie. Lionel Richie knows Stevie Wonder. They were supposed to do the song together. Quincy never got back to him. Michael Jackson hears about it and phones Lionel Richie and says, I want to be part of this. I want to help you write the song. And the two of them spent weeks writing the song together. And they wrote that song right up to the night before it was recorded.
Really?
So they finished that night before the song was meant to be recorded. Mm. And at that stage, Stevie Wonder calls and is like, hey, I want to do this. And they're like, no, the song's written. It's done. You can come and sing on the song. So he does sing on it. But anyway, the planning behind the song was so extensive because they wanted these famous celebrities all to record on the song, mm-hmm. but the problem was, how do you get all of those people in one room at the same time? And so the strategy was, the American Music Awards are going to be in town that week, and everyone was going to be there anyway. So let's get into studio after the show and record this thing.
Goodness.
But they could only do it in one night. No one could come back and do it. It had to be done in that one night because after that, everyone was going to go do their tours and they were going to go around the world and do whatever they needed to do. Anyway, so they go in, the American Music Awards finishes and off they run into the recording studio to go and record the song. So what you're looking like 10, 11 o'clock at night, they hit the studio. They record the whole night through to the morning.
Sure.
Diana Ross was there at 6 o'clock in the morning still. So they recorded the whole way through the night. And there was obviously drama between the people and whatever. And Quincy Jones notoriously put a sign in front of the studio saying, leave your ego at the door, because he knew he was going to be handling a whole lot of divas. And one of the big diva moments was Prince. So Prince had been asked to perform on the song.
Yes.
They'd even had a little part for him and everything. And he heard Michael was going to be there. And he was like, hell no, I'm not going to be in the same room as Michael Jackson. And he refused to pitch for the recording. And they were still trying to call him during the recording. And he was like, I'm not coming. I told you, I'm not coming to the recording. I'm not singing on that song. So he never landed up singing. And Kenny Loggins landed up taking his part. If you watch the documentary, there's a documentary about this on Netflix called The Greatest Night in Pop. I think that's what it's called. There's just so many interesting, like, for example, Bob Dylan could not, because Bob Dylan wrote his own music.
Yes.
He couldn't get his head around the interpretation of the lyrical content and the phrasing of it.
Yeah.
He couldn't get it. And so at one point, Stevie Wonder goes down to the piano and he gives him the notes and he says, these are the notes you have to sing.
Yeah.
And he sings it for Bob Dylan.
Yes.
And Bob Dylan is like, oh, okay, I'll sing it. But Bob Dylan was so embarrassed because he was in this room with all these like iconic singers and he was like, I can't get the phrasing on the song.
Yeah.
And Stevie Wonder played it for him note by note so that he could get it. And one of the funniest moments is apparently at one point Ray Charles wanted to go to the bathroom and obviously he didn't know his way around because he was blind. And so no one was everyone was doing their thing, and they couldn't. They were
into themselves.
Yeah,
they could.
So apparently, Stevie Wonder goes up to Ray Charles, and he helps him to the bathroom.
It's not funny, but it's funny.
And the rest of the guys stood back, and they were like, "If that's not the blind leading the blind, we don't know what is." And so there are all these like interesting moments about this creation of this beautiful piece of music that in the end became the biggest selling charity single of all time, 20 million units, and changed so many people's lives.
What a story. We're going to end with two songs.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So we've got two songs. The last two songs, so the first one's Bob Marley, a song called Redemption Song. It was released in 1980, so a year before Bob Marley passed away. But he had already written the song in 1979. He had just been diagnosed with cancer, and he started writing this song. And he was heavily inspired by this Pan-Africanist called Marcus Garvey, who was a Jamaican political leader who had done this very stirring speech in 1937, so many years before Bob Marley, and he in the song talks about emancipate yourself from your mental slavery, and so Bob Marley references specific lines from that speech. This political leader, Marcus Garvey, was the guy who started the Universal Negro Improvement Association and African Communities League. That's the name of this league. It still exists to this day. And he declared himself the president of Africa at one point. But anyway, this song grew out of this, you know, like, you need to sometimes... Your biggest hurdle is yourself.
Mm.
And if you can break away or emancipate yourself from the shackles that are holding you back, you can move forward. Mm. And I think the song meant so much to Bob Marley at a time when he was struggling with his own strife.
Mm.
Now, Bob Marley was famous for writing protest songs. But this specific protest song, which is a more internal protest, like you need to uplift yourself, completely broke the rules of any of his other songs that he had written before. Usually his songs are quite uplifting and quite jovial. This is one of the first songs where he stripped it all down and he had just a guitar and his voice, which was very reminiscent once again of Bob Dylan, and then did this song, which compared to all his other music is very uncharacteristic, yet this is considered one of his most significant songs in his discography. So that's Bob Marley.
Yeah.
And then we will end off with my brr, the Madonna of the townships, they used to call her. Now, I think, you know, this is something a lot of like very extroverted people struggle with, where they're not taken seriously because they're just seen as a clown. And so, you know, Brenda Fassie was this exceptionally charismatic woman, like over the top, and she was just about doing party music. She was a bubblegum pop diva, you know. And this specific song basically says, you know what, I might be a bubblegum diva, but actually I've also got something to say.
Yeah.
And this specific song was released in 1990, so it was released a month after Nelson Mandela was released. And the song talks about something that for many people, they thought this was never going to be a possibility, that South Africa was never going to have a black president. So for her to say something like this is before there was even a concept that Nelson Mandela would be the president of South Africa. That wasn't even a done deal at that point. There was so much turmoil in the country. People didn't know what the future was going to bring. And she was like saying, you know, this is a possibility. This is something that can happen. And she writes this song and it becomes this iconic, so with Chico Twala, and it becomes this iconic piece of music. But it's interesting because she also referenced Zola Budd in another song. So she was very good at like alluding
social
to pop.
Commentary
exactly, alluding to pop figures. And And this song, once again, like quite a stripped down, basic song, but the message is the key in this instance.
It's been wonderful. Thank you so much, Thank Sheldon. You. Really appreciate it. And see you next week.
POV Music. On the street,
on the air,
and on the dance floor. Click kaya959.co.za.
This is how we do it.
To download the Point of View podcast.